Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Energy Unplugged. This is your host, Stuart Wiedeye, currently president of CEO and CEO of Blossman Gas and president of Alliance Auto Gas. And I've got my trusty sidekick, Mark Denton, otherwise known as the Sage of South Georgia, a short timer in the energy industry. He's been in the LPG business for 42 years. We're not sure how he's made it far, but welcome, Mark. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Good morning. Really excited about having Tucker on with us this morning.
Well, that's right. We've got our guest, Tucker Perkins, today, who's the CEO of Propane Education and Research Council. And it should be a really great conversation. I would say he's one of the most knowledgeable people in the LPG industry in the United States and even globally. Rather entertaining speaker as well. So, Tucker, welcome to Energy Unplugged.
Well, Stuart and Mark, thank you. That's a tall order. I hope I can fulfill at least half of that.
That's right. Okay. Well, we're really glad to have you. And as we start our podcast series, we wanted you to be our first guest because of your prominence and your wit combined all in one package.
Well, I'm really looking forward to, you know, what you have to say and how you take this podcast over, you know, the next months and years, because, you know, as we have discussed often, I think you have a unique perspective, and you know, really, you have led a great revolution for the propane industry. So I'm honored to be a part of this today.
Great. Well, Tucker, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about how you got started in the propane industry? I know you've been in the natural gas industry as well, but give us a little background on your work history.
Well, I got started in the propane industry like so many of us did. I think I was more or less born into it, right? I remember as a child kind of seeing my dad trundle off to works, often going with him. I learned to paint tanks and cut grass at an early age. And so I was exposed to it really from birth on. Kind of was a regular attendee with him at the office from about age 5 or 6 on, and I stayed with it through college, building bulk plants and doing really every job you can do in the propane industry. After college, I really went to work in the natural gas industry, and it's a really good balance over time as I look back to have a broad knowledge about LNG, all aspects of natural gas pipelines and how that system works. And then eventually, after a quick stint as a construction manager, building big infrastructure projects like airports and pipelines and bridges, I came back to the propane industry. And I've been really in the propane industry almost 30 years in the second version of my career.
Okay. Well, and you also have an engineering degree from Virginia Tech. Is that correct?
I am. I am a civil engineer. Actually was licensed as a professional engineer and was a consulting engineer for a few years. And of course, I find even today, I use that engineering degree quite a bit as we begin to think about the future and the environment. And it really all ties together, a little bit of physics, a little bit of chemistry, and a little bit of real world ability to think about, can you construct that? It's been a really useful background for me.
Well, and how's the Hokies football season going?
Well, you know, we're looking into basketball now. We've completely looked past football. But since we beat Villanova, the number 3 team, I think, in the country in basketball, we're just focused on basketball right now. Every team in North Carolina beat us in football, and I suspect anybody we play in the next couple of weeks will beat us too.
Well, and that's okay. And look, my alma mater neither has won a game nor lost a game in its entire history, so I have no room to talk about anybody else's football team. 0-0. So, Tucker, tell us a little bit about the Propane Education Research Council and what it does in the United States as far as the propane industry itself.
Yeah, thanks. So appreciate you saying Propane Education and Research Council, because I think that pretty well says what we do. And I will refer to that from now on as PERC, the acronym for that. But really, PERC has 3 functions. And PERC is a unique organization in that we are a nonprofit, but we really do 3 things. One, we're certainly all about safety, to make sure that our industry is well trained, that our practices are proven, that customers are aware of how to use propane safely. So we're all about safety, whether it's training or consumer education for training and safety. We're certainly also about how the market can grow, whether it's talking to the industry about different uses for propane or to the consumers about how and why they should use propane. So training, safety, education. And then I think the third part, which is to me one of the most exciting parts of the job, is we really are able to make investments and drive technology and innovation in not only how propane is used today, but how it will be used a decade from today or 10 decades from today. And it's a lovely perspective for me to be able to talk about how propane is being used today and to make sure we're doing it safely in the right way, to help customers today think about how they want to use it, but then also to really shape how propane will be used in 50 years. It's so funny when, you know, when we talk environmentally and everybody wants to talk about, you know, this world that seems to magically happen in 2050. And I think so many people have completely lost sight of the fact that it's 2020 and we have a climate, you know, that we're concerned about today. And with propane and natural gas and some other clean energies, we have an opportunity to really change how we use energies today. And we don't have to wait until some mythical 30 years later in order to see benefit. So it's a great perspective for me to be able to participate, you know, in this industry, not only for today, but for decades in the, to come.
Well, that's good to hear. And by the way, Energy Unplugged, we're going to talk a lot about the propane industry, but we're also going to talk about other sources and methods of delivering energy to consumers and businesses and industries in our country. I think a lot of things that are being propagated out there, I have a lot of technical issues when it comes to energy density, but I want to stick to a little bit about the Propane Education and Research Council's role. And for any of you listening that are in the propane business or the LPG business here in the United States, I really want to, Tucker, if you wouldn't mind, talk a little bit about the training programs that you have, some of the things that have evolved over many years, but particularly in the last several years in terms of the education that we're providing to industry members to improve their competence, their professionalism, and their skills. But before you get that, Mark, I know you go way back. 42 years, I guess you started when you were six. Was that about right, Mark?
That's right. I was a wee lad, but started young.
Well, some of the things that you started with in your industry, you went into a training program. Maybe give us a little background, if you wouldn't mind, before Tucker talks about some of the activities of PERC on the training and education they provide on the skills.
So I started out with a company called TexGas. That was a company part of Union Allied Chemical out of Houston, Texas. And TexGas had five propane divisions. And one of the things that I'm most thankful for is that TexGas believed in training. And so they had probably at the time in the late 70s, early 80s, the state-of-the-art manager training program that I was fortunate to be a part of. And they taught us the industry from the ground up, and they taught us every aspect of it. If you were going to be in a frontline management role, they really taught you that you needed to know every aspect of the business. So that was something I was very proud to be a part of, and it has shaped my career.
And I think one of the neat things about that is in the 70s, 80s, and through the early 90s, a lot of people were joining. A lot of young people were joining this industry because it had a bright future. And Tucker, you mentioned not only today in 2020, but we've got a bright future as an industry. And one of the things PERC has been doing is working on the technical training for the technicians in our industry. You want to give us a little background on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, just like the world has become much more digital in the way we read or receive information, you know, really training needed to change too. I mean, 25 years ago, you were trained by a senior person who showed you how to do it hands-on, and you did it, you know, while being supervised. And kind of the way you were trained was fairly well word of mouth with a mentor. And kind of fast forward to today, we still firmly believe in having mentors and having observers to really see that people are doing things the right way. But we've gone now to where we're able to have heavy video content, digital media that allow people to not only read about what they're doing, but to visually see how to do it. And, you know, it's amazing if you look at the breadth of the propane industry. We need to drive trucks. We need to do that safely. We need to fill our trucks or unload our trucks safely. We deal with cylinders in a whole host of areas as the nation, you know, is beginning to realize today as restaurants really begin to discover patio heat in a lot of places for the first time. You know, then there's all the safe installation, safe service, so many different points of contact with the customer and the appliances. And so that whole training method now has gone to a digital technique where people can do it at work, can see it at home, can review videos. And it really has been a marvelous transition, and a transition that's nowhere near completed. I think one of the things about this, you just continue to improve your videos, you continue to improve your documents, and you continue to check to see if people are being trained as best they can be, as fast as they can be, and that you're enhancing the skills. And I think our industry is lovely in that, you know, people come in to be a driver and many of them become a service technician, then become the manager. You know, there's so many opportunities for growth in this industry. It's a great time to be involved in the propane or LPG industry.
And, you know, that's a really great point, Tucker. There is a great future for anybody that gets into our industry, and there's mobility. If you learn the business in Connecticut, and for some reason you have to move to Atlanta, Georgia, or Salt Lake City, Utah, you're going to have a job on the other end because of the specialized skill set. And one of the things that's most exciting to me that PERC has done, and what's unique about us in the United States, in most countries around the world, there may be 3 to 6 or 7 propane companies in the entire country. Here in the United States, there's almost 4,000 propane companies. So PERC has sort of become the central standardized testing and training ground in terms of content for those 4,000 companies and their employees. Is that a fair statement, Tucker?
Yeah, we just place great importance on having safely trained employees, having customers that are aware of the features and benefits and how to use propane safely and when something needs to be attended to. And I do think appliances are going to be moving smarter. I mean, I think we're not that far from living in a world where, you know, when your stove isn't working just right, it would call a technician and say, hey, come check me out sometime. The level of safety continues to improve, but absolutely, it's a great time to be in this industry. For me, I've always enjoyed, you know, the fact that every day is slightly different, right? Today, you know, you may be calling on customers. Tomorrow, you are working in the office and managing. There's just such a variety of tasks available. And as you say, there's almost an infinite upward path for people who want to advance and want to do a good job.
Well, something you alluded to a few moments ago, Tucker, is there's a movement around the world under the umbrella of climate change or the fact that we need to reduce emissions to eliminate fossil fuels. And it's really odd in many respects because the irony of that is fossil fuels, very energy dense products, are basically in like 96% of all the things that we consume every day, whether they're prescription drug medications, chapstick, detergents to wash your clothes with, refrigeration, your laptop. You say, well, I'm being a great steward of the earth by driving around an electric vehicle or a hybrid, but where do people think those tires and the dashboard in the car, all those were made with fossil fuel products. So would you care to elaborate a little bit about why fossil fuels are demonized so much in the world that we live in?
Well, I wish I did really understand. And, you know, as you've already said, I kind of approach this. I start as a scientist engineer, and maybe sometimes that's a handicap for, you know, understanding the world that some people seem to envision, because I've never understood why fossil fuels are demonized. And in fact, most people will talk about electrification as a path to decarbonization, where today in the U.S., in 38 states, conventional propane is a cleaner fuel than electricity. And, we're going to see it where some states are mandating electric vehicles. Well, the electric vehicles, forget the fact that the grid cannot handle that amount of electricity. Just be aware that the current grid is dirtier than even a gasoline vehicle in many of those states. So the net impact, where people are consumed about thinking that electricity is cleaner, the net impact will be an increase in the very emission they were trying to address, which in that particular case is greenhouse gases. So, yeah, I mean, I am quick to say, Stuart, and I say it as often as I can, that fossil fuels are not the problem. Fuels are not binary. They're not just clean or dirty. There are some that are relatively dirty. And I think fuel oil would be one. Coal is certainly one. Wood is certainly a fuel that's relatively dirty to use. There are also other fuels that are relatively clean. Nuclear would be at the top of the list. Hydro also there, solar, wind for sure, but propane and natural gas. And so the issue should be, how do we clean up our climate? And by the way, most of the world is fascinated with greenhouse gases and climate change. I hope COVID-19 has begun to show people that there is a complete link between climate and health. And so most people won't even think about other parts that of the climate that are very bad for your health, namely particulate matter, nitrogen oxides, oxides of sulfur, which is a huge issue for a lot of electricity being produced. And so I love to talk about climate, yes, greenhouse gas reduction, and I love to immediately go and talk about health, and I also then love to talk about justice. Who pays for that? Where does that money come from? And there are so many issues. We could talk for days about those issues combined. But to attack fossil fuels as the problem is quite unfair. And Stuart, just to keep going for a second, there was an article in The Guardian in Europe, and it really impacted me because the writer said, those of us in the fossil fuel industry are just clinging to our past and just clinging to our jobs and just clinging to this fuel. And that could not be further from the truth. We are also advocating for clean energy. We're advocating for clean climate and a healthy climate. We're advocating for justice where people can best afford their utility bills. It's just that we certainly believe that clean, healthy, and justice aren't achieved with this very narrow path, which is only about electrification. It's achieved by a very broad path. And that broad path, sadly, for many, will include natural gas and propane. No question about it.
Well, and it should. And one of the great ironies of many in the environmental movement is the disdain for nuclear energy. But if we all went to accounting 101 class, the first thing they tell you is there's no such thing as a free lunch. And wind and solar are perceived as having zero emissions or any no emissions or carbon intensity associated with them. But just for example, building one wind turbine requires 900 tons of steel and 25 tons of concrete and 45 tons of non-recyclable plastic. Where does that stuff come from? So it's really a bit of an irony, and apparently people are just reading political reports, whether it's from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and extracting things that seem convenient to them. But tell us a little bit about your understanding and knowledge in speaking about cooking with gas. One of the great programs is the World LPG Cooking with Gas Initiative for underdeveloped countries around the world. Could you share a little bit about that, Tucker?
Yeah, and I love that story. And it's a story that's been really difficult to translate into how propane can benefit America. But if you think across the world, particularly in Africa and other parts of the world, you know, they're still living in a world that's consumed by burning wood, or worse, burning animal dung. And so the statistic that we regularly see is that about 4 million people a year are dying from indoor air pollution, literally because they cook with wood or dung. And in many of those countries, we've been able to take small propane stoves, and now we have changed not only the lady of the house who's doing the cooking, finding the wood, building the fires. Literally, that takes entire day. We replace that wood stove with a propane stove. Their food, all of a sudden, meal preparation is now a 30 or 40 minute part of their morning or evening.
And Tucker, that's an important point. You were speaking of justice a while ago, and the United Nations, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, is one of the biggest advocates for this transition to propane for cooking, because it's a women's rights issues around the world. They have spent, women in many parts of the world are going around having to collect solid waste materials to cook with. And as you mentioned, the solid waste materials, but the United Nations is a very vigorous and strong advocate for this cooking for life as a women's rights issue, to free up their time to do more productive activities and improve their quality of life. Isn't that something that they're very focused on there?
Absolutely. The United Nations gets it and has been wildly supportive of this. And Stuart, you're exactly right. It not only empowers, it actually makes her life much safer. It makes her time spent with family doing the things that mothers do that are so important for the family unit. She's now able to do it because she's not out, you know, foraging for wood, deforesting to a degree, you know, in dangerous places, finding dung. The air is cleaner. It has been an amazing transformation. So there's a good example where you have to think about what is the current state, because if you're burning wood or coal or oil, certainly a migration to propane is much cleaner. And I think most people understand that. I think translating that experience back to the United States, though, now, it's still factual that in many cases, using propane directly in an efficient appliance for energy-dense applications like heating water, like perhaps producing power, powering a vehicle, all of those energy-dense applications, that using propane, even conventional propane, is much cleaner than replacing that job and surrendering it to electricity. And so I think that it's really easy for people to understand how replacing a wood fire in Africa might be cleaner by using propane. But it's equally true to say that still using energy-dense applications in the U.S. is cleaner with propane.
Well, Mark, how do you think it would go over in the Denton household if Mrs. Denton had to go out and collect wood to cook with every day?
We would be eating out a lot, and we would be going where they had gas cooking.
Tucker, to go back to the point, you know, bring it back here to the United States. We have a big movement, and supported by the Sierra Club, the NRDC, the Environmental Defense Fund, and I could go down to this long list of environmental groups that have massive funding from billionaires, from Wall Street interests, from foundations such as the Rockefeller Foundation. Why are they promoting the electrification of cooking in the home and the electrification of water heating when the direct use of gas is so much better for the environment? Do you understand what's going on there?
Well, I would love to think that their motives are positive. Certainly, you know, a skeptic might say that a motive is to attract capital, but I would really take a higher road and think that many people believe that this grid that they envision, not today, is so clean, but in 30 or 40 years, that it'll just be made up of solar and wind, and that the grid will essentially be so much cleaner than it is today. And I think what most people fail to realize is all of us in the propane industry also champion a clean earth. I mean, most of us live a little close to the land, hopefully. We I've spent the entire weekend on the Chesapeake Bay. I would argue no one is more interested in a clean climate and a healthy community than I am. But I'm also painfully aware that this grid that people envision will not ever be 100% solar or wind. It's just too complex. And even if it were to become that, it would not be that environmentally appealing because it's still going to be comprised of batteries, backup sources. I mean, until people are prepared to deal with intermittency, not having power perhaps when they need it, they're going to have to need a mix of sources. And I think even all of us in the propane industry completely agree. There's no one magic fuel, right? Sometimes electricity is fine. Sometimes natural gas is needed. Today, sometimes diesel fuel has been needed to do the job it does best, even when the metric considers its impact on the environment. And in many of those cases, propane does the job best. I already talked about one, heating water. It is really difficult to find a way to heat water better than using natural gas or propane. It's just a job we do really well. Our appliances are 97% efficient in many cases. We use it directly at the home or business. And so that's a great example. And I travel sometimes and we'll talk to people. So this morning I took my shower using the most modern propane water heater you can use. I hope you took your shower with an electric water heater. Who was better for the environment? And in about 49 of the 50 states, the propane water heater was better for the environment. And by the way, it probably gave me Washington,
the exception being Washington State, where a major portion of their electricity is generated by hydropower. Is that correct, Tucker?
Yes, it's Washington State is really a very clean state. Believe it or not, Vermont, because it's almost completely hydroelectric. And then, you know, there are some states across South Carolina, but a strong commitment to nuclear is why South Carolina has a clean power grid today. Now, let me just ask you, Stuart, do you think that that nuclear power will increase, or do you think they probably won't be able to build any more nuclear power plants? Clearly, the answer is highly unlikely they ever build another nuclear power plant. And so nuclear is this great power for energy density. You talked about energy density earlier, and I know most people want to glaze over when we talk about that because it's just beyond what most people think about. Most people want to turn on the stove and have, you know, a meal cooked. They want to turn on the shower and have hot water. But we're moving from really good energy dense fuels like nuclear or coal or diesel fuel to these fuels that aren't so energy dense, solar, wind, very difficult to harness them to do the jobs that we have expected our fuels to do.
That's exactly right. But you mentioned Vermont a while ago, and an interesting fact, Tucker, is that Vermont, at the urging of many environmentalists and organizations advocating for climate change improvement, decommissioned their nuclear plant and tried to substitute wind and solar. And in fact, between 1990 and 2015, a 25-year period, Vermont's emissions, instead of falling, increased by 16% because they got rid of the nuclear. And there's a great author, and I would call him a scholar and well-researched guy named Robert Bryce. Anybody that's interested in learning more about energy should read his books. And he advocates for this concept of natural gas to nuclear. And of course, in the propane industry, we would say natural gas and propane because where natural gas is not available, that's where propane comes into play. But nuclear energy has got greater density, zero emissions. And one of the things that's most misunderstood about nuclear is you could stack all the nuclear waste generated in this country in the past 60 years and put it on the size of one football field. And it's incredibly efficient the way it delivers energy. But in the meantime, we can use gas directly, as you mentioned, and getting rid of nuclear, which has been a tenet of all people who supposedly have, let's just say they have good intentions, but they're more dreamers. They don't understand the issues with solar and wind itself. There's no such thing as a free lunch, going back to our accounting 101, but we really should be using gas and nuclear if we want to make the most positive impact of anything known today.
And I even think when you say we want to, I think it's even we will have to. I mean, I think even studying a lot of the European position right now, and Europe is at least a decade or so ahead of us in their march towards this clean power and this zeal for clean power. But even I was visiting with a German wind expert a couple weeks ago. And now here's a person who advocates for wind in the middle of wind and arguably one of the most progressive areas about using wind. And his comment to me was, my goal is that 50% of our energy will come from wind by 2050. The other 50% will have to come from much more traditional sources like natural gas or propane, because you have to balance the intermittency with solar or wind with something that's stable if, in fact, your consumers and your manufacturers want to use power throughout the day and night. And so, yeah, I'm often amazed that, you know, you're talking about nuclear, most people don't want to consider full fuel cycle. Sometimes people will call to it the full economic analysis. But as I'm quick to say, all of the inputs and outputs, what goes into creating, transporting, using, and then what's left over. And, you know, I think people are quick to see perhaps, you know, what that means for the coal industry, for example. It's quite easy to see a pile of coal ash and understand that that's what's left over after you produce electricity from coal. But for some reason, for solar or wind or even batteries, they don't look at it that way. And I would argue that you, I'm sure, look at batteries and think about that tremendous amount of energy and input that goes into collecting the minerals, building them, refining them, putting them together in a battery. And then what happens when that battery is at the end of its use? It's end of its useful life, right? There's no, you're quick to say there is no free lunch for anything, nuclear power all the way up to solar and wind.
Well, and that's one of the great ironies is thinking beyond stage one, and there, you have to look at the entire cycle, and electricity actually is not a primary source of energy. It's only a delivery method or an energy carrier. It's the way electricity generated somewhere else gets to a home and a business. And that's one of the great things about the direct use of energy. But tell us a little bit about your podcast and the Path to Zero and sort of the tagline that's being adopted by the industry in the United States, the LP gas industry. What does Path to Zero mean exactly, Tucker?
Well, I actually love the title of that because I think, one, it clearly shows that we are supportive of clean climate. And while most people want to talk about zero emissions, and they generally, you see that often in the context about electric vehicles, that it's absurd to think that electric vehicles have zero emissions. In fact, it's really absurd to even think about it, even when the vehicle is still, if you will, a vehicle still giving off emissions. It's painted, it has tires, there are things. But let's go beyond that abstract version and say that electric vehicles have to be recharged. When they're recharged, they actually create emissions. And so Path to Zero is a nod of the hat to, in fact, the fact that, yes, we all want to move to a cleaner climate, a healthier community, and we are on the path to zero. And Stuart, I've heard you say it before, so I know you're well aware of it. But what people don't even realize today, our carbon emissions in the United States have decreased significantly over the last 5 or 6 years. Why? Because we've begun to substitute natural gas generation from coal generation. We use less diesel or oil generation and more clean sources like propane and natural gas. We're already decreasing our impact on the climate. And in fact, much faster than many places who have this mythical goal, but the mythical goal is at a point in the future. And in the meanwhile, they're making no progress towards a cleaner climate. So Path to Zero, one, is a tip of the hat that, yes, we're completely engaged in moving to a cleaner climate and reducing our carbon emissions. But also, it's quick to point out that I don't know that you ever get to zero with any technology. And secondly, I like to talk about, it's not just about zero greenhouse gases. It's about those pollutants that impact human health, particularly lung health, and create asthma, COPD, a whole host of breathing diseases or disorders that come from particulate matter and oxides of nitrogen. So Path to Zero, we want to talk about all of those emissions, and we want to talk about it really in an intellectually honest conversation that we're not going to zero. We're not going below zero. We're going to get closer and closer and closer to zero.
Now, that's a good point. But, you know, the Path to Zero, we should be eliminating wood and reducing coal and diesel consumption and substituting it with gas and nuclear over the next 50 years. And where and when able, supplement with the wind and solar. The thing that's hard to understand is, despite the wild growth, the billions, the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been subsidies put into the wind and solar industry, we're only producing 3% of our over 100 quadrillion BTUs consumed here in the United States by wind and solar. I mean, it's less than four quadrillion BTUs. And in fact, the consumption is increasing faster than the wind and solar. So to say the world's going to be even half of 50 of wind and solar is really difficult to believe if you're sincere and looking at the facts and you understand physics, first of all, but energy density as well. So moving along, one of the things that we in our industry, and I think the natural gas industry as well, are advocate that on-site power generation could be a legitimate path. Perhaps you have solar at your home or business and you supplement it with a micro CHP, which is a micro combined heating and power piece of equipment. Think of it as a generator that runs as often as it needs to for years and years and years, not just when you need it, when the power grid goes down. But could you elaborate a little bit about hybrid systems and the role that propane and natural gas can play when you combine it with on-site solar or rooftop solar?
Yeah, and I think one of the unique positions of the propane industry is that we embrace the use of solar and wind, both residentially and commercially, right? We are willing to partner, and we firmly believe that we should partner with renewable forms of energy. We just also believe that there's, for those intermittent and variable sources, you need a reliable source. And that source becomes, as you just correctly said, this combined heat and power unit. And so the technology has moved so far, right? Let's just back up for a second. Engine technology in general, even in the last decade, I've seen, you know, the next sea change of technology in engines. And it's largely based on the fact that we are probably a little bit smarter about really what combustion means. We're better able to control combustion through modern controls, and we're able to manufacture these engines with a little bit more precision. So kind of the marriage, if you will, of science, engineering, technology, and manufacturing gives us very efficient engines. And so now we take those engines and we produce massive amounts of power with really minute fuel consumption. When you fully combust fuel, there's very little left over, right? You produce power. So combined heat and power in conjunction with solar or wind, if people want to do it, and you generally would have a little battery application there too. And we tend to really want to shy away from batteries because batteries are so ugly in the manufacturing and disposal. But I think, you know, in the system.
Right there. If people saw the landscape of mining battery materials, the cobalt, the lithium, and the nickel that comes out of those, and also if they observed the child labor that's being used in certain countries to produce the cobalt, it would make them cry. It would be just heartbreaking to see.
You have already introduced two images today. One is one of the most positive images about how propane works, and that is to see firsthand how it changes the life of someone who moves from dung to propane. There's no more positive image that I've ever had than seeing that firsthand. The other thing, though, you just correctly said, is there's hardly any image that's more disgusting than the image of seeing truly how cobalt and lithium get to be in a battery. And it starts in just horrendous places with child labor. It is
heartbreaking.
Earliest underbellies. And by the way, I don't see that changing, right? Because lithium cobalt generally exist in places where child labor is just almost accepted. And it always fascinates me that here we want to talk about these technologies without any regard for human life, child labor. We don't talk about it. And it should be talked about. It actually should be seen with your eyes to really understand how disgusting it is. And how, again, you hear me continually talk about this system, right? How did we get the energy put together in the package, and what do we do when it's disposed of, and what happens with what's left over? And those are the clean systems. Those are the just systems that we ought to advocate for. In no way do you hear me talking bad about solar or wind or hydro or nuclear, because I'm consumed about the system. And I think when you do that, you realize it's not fossil fuels that are the problem. It's perhaps sometimes the jobs, because there are really clean fossil fuels. And we need to keep that out in front of the public.
Well, that's right. And one of the things that I think is misunderstood is those issues with the electric battery that goes into the transportation sector, and some other issues that are related to the power generation itself. But we have an opportunity to educate people, and let's talk a little bit about transportation and vehicles. And I know this is something that's very near and dear to Mark's Denton's heart, because he's been working for over a decade on putting propane into commercial vehicles. But there are over 28 million propane or LPG vehicles running around the world right now, and unfortunately, there's only about 170,000 here in the United States. Why has the United States been so slow to adapt propane as a transportation fuel, despite its great costs, savings, its environmental benefits, reducing greenhouse gases? It's something that we can do right now, today. What's sort of the issue that's holding us back from creating more environmental benefits in the transportation sector using propane?
Well, I think our industry, I'm not sure we made a mistake, but I think our industry has been so cautious in going against gasoline and diesel that we never thought about propane as a fuel for the consumer's vehicle, right? Because of the complexity of EPA regulations, because of the availability of gasoline or diesel on nearly every corner of the street in America, that, you know, our focus has been on commercial, really medium-duty vehicles. And so certainly UPS and FedEx and Amazon, they're well-versed in how propane works for them. We've really focused, as I'm quick to say, on vehicles where payload and range matter. And I think today that probably is beginning to pay off, because I'm probably in a minority, but I do tend to believe that over the next 20 years, consumer vehicles will become more and more electrified. And I think that, I don't think that's really driven by necessarily a motivation to go to clean. It's driven by this fiat from others that said, you know, engines will be motors and consumers will drive electric cars. I already can see it in California. If that were to really happen today, greenhouse gas emissions would go up, because electric cars pollute more for greenhouse gases than electric cars have a higher greenhouse gas output than gasoline cars today. Nobody seems to pay attention to that. But the propane industry has focused on medium and heavy duty vehicles. And I think that's going to really pay off for us now, because even as you sit here today, there isn't a future for medium duty or heavy duty electrified vehicles. And no matter what, you know, people want to talk about, clearly batteries of tomorrow will be different than the batteries of today. And the range of tomorrow will be better than the range of today. But commercial vehicles need to do the job that to which they were intended to be done. They need to deliver bricks and lumber. They need to deliver heavy packages. And so propane, in fact, is the modern fuel to run the transportation network. Much cleaner than diesel, much cleaner than gasoline, and certainly easier to get to that level of clean. So our modern engines are not only more efficient, simpler, cleaner, cheaper. That whole system is just so compelling that now you begin to see manufacturers completely frustrated with how complex diesel is to get to clean, how expensive it is to get to clean. You now see them turning towards propane. And I really do think the next decade is going to be a revolution in migration to propane fuel vehicles.
Because of the environmental benefits. And, you know, you mentioned something a moment ago, but I wanted to comment that, you know, cobalt and lithium, the materials associated with the electric battery, more than 90% of the supply chain globally is controlled by China. And do we really want our country dependent on China for the materials to electrify our transportation sector? And we know we've got the problems with the medium duty vehicles, as you just mentioned, Tucker. But Mark, I mean, you have a great story in Muskogee County, Georgia. Law enforcement is another area that I think is very important. And we had a deputy sheriff who got very emotional because, you know, where does propane come from? And maybe, Mark, you want to comment on that real quick.
Yeah, I think law enforcement is a great story to tell, because a lot of those men and women in law enforcement are also military people who have served their country overseas in a lot of cases, and they're very loyal and patriotic. And so John Darr with Muskogee County, Georgia, sheriff, that was the point for him, that when he found out that propane was 99% domestically produced and that he could use a fuel that was clean and abundant and readily available today, and he wasn't going to have to give up any of his job duties, his performance, his deputies doing their job, that's what sold him. It wasn't so much the cost savings, even though he had a great cost savings. It was the fact that I have a clean, abundant domestic fuel that will do exactly what I need done in law enforcement.
Well, you know, unfortunately, I'm old enough to remember the embargoes of the past. And I think about even the creation of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I think about these fits and starts we've really had, where we had too much reliance on interests that weren't necessarily aligned with American interest. And to your point, and some people would argue, well, those materials and minerals exist inside the U.S. They do, but just as a practical reality, we won't mine them. The mining of those materials is too filthy, whether you want to talk about water pollution or air pollution or labor or the expense. We won't mine those materials in the U.S. It just won't happen. And so that whole issue of energy security and energy independence is often overlooked. I will say, though, Mark, to your point, and I love talking about police fleets, one, their performance is often increased. And I don't think people realize that. But the performance of a propane vehicle is really exciting compared to the performance of a gasoline or diesel vehicle because of just the octane rating of propane. But the other issue, and I love to talk about paratransit, an area that I think you know well, but paratransit is kind of this unseen network, but municipalities need to transport their citizens to the doctor, to medical facilities. It's really necessary, and it's a costly venture. Well, using propane in lieu of gasoline or diesel will reduce those expenses in many cases by half, 50%. And so now the net effect is you can provide more service at less cost. And I think, you know, we want to talk about energy independence. How wonderful is it that we can achieve that using propane? We want to talk about energy security. How wonderful is it that we achieve that using propane? We want to talk about cutting costs and increasing service to the elderly, to those who need it most. That to me is, you know, almost the perfect trifecta. And by the way, let's don't look past the fact that we also were positive for the environment. We also were positive for human health, both those riding in the paratransit and those in the communities in which the paratransit being served. So win, 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 win. I mean, you scratch your head sometimes about why is this not the fuel of choice across the country?
Well, indeed. And Tucker, not only are you enlightened and informed energy expert, a legitimate one, I would say at that, you're also a man of many talents, whether it comes to bowling or golf or fly fishing in the backcountry of Idaho. Have you been engaged in any of those fun activities here recently?
Well, I would love to say, I think the last time I bowled, Stuart, was the great bowling challenge with you. But I will get outside as much as I can. And I think that's one reason I spent this weekend fishing on the Chesapeake Bay and just marveling at how beautiful, you know, America can be on a golden, you know, early winter's day. So I think so many people who want to work against us think that we're just clinging to our fossil fuel past, as the Guardian said, when in fact we are equal stewards of this earth and equal stewards of the environment, but we're concerned about things that I don't think people want to be concerned about. I can talk to any environmentalist and just talk about justice and who pays for these things and why would government need to invest trillions in this energy system that already exists? Why couldn't government spend trillions to improve education, health, housing, better policing, if you will? I mean, such a topic of the day. There are so many places for federal or state or community investment. Why not leave that clean issue to us? So, yeah, I get a chance to get out and do things, but I will tell you right now, I spend many hours of my week trying to get, I think, well-intentioned people to realize that perhaps they're not on, you know, the optimum path to a clean climate.
Well said. Optimum path. I think that's good. The optimum path to zero, not just today, but into the future. And Tucker, we really appreciate you taking time to visit with us today. It's been very informative, and we look forward to having you back on a future podcast with Energy Unplugged. And we've got a lot more to talk about, and I hope everyone has a good week. And again, Tucker Perkins, the CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council and the sage of South Georgia, Mark Denton. This is Stuart Weedye, your host, and thank you for listening today.